Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on vacation. Scientists studying whales and dolphins find that these creatures share mental, social, and behavioral traits with people. As part of our ongoing series, Environmental Outlook, we look at the intelligence of these animals and what MRIs tell us about the way their brains have evolved. Joining us in the studio are Naomi Rose of the Humane Society International and Janet Mann of Georgetown University. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And joining us from a studio room with a view in Santa Barbara, California, Tony Frohoff of Terramar Research. Tony, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. Well, Janet Mann, you have said that these animals are like intelligent aliens. What do you mean by that?
Well, dolphins are separated from us by, well, from the primate lineage by over 90 million years. And so they have evolved brains, essentially, that are quite different from us and live in a very different environment, totally different. And their world is, in many ways, different from our own. Yet they are clearly intelligent. So in some ways, they are similar but different than us, the way we imagine aliens to be.
And Naomi, what we were talking about dolphins and whales. What's the difference between them?
Well, it's just a common term. You know, it's really just a matter of size. What we consider a whale, the killer whale, which is also called the orca, is actually a dolphin. It's the largest dolphin. And so they all belong to the same family, Delphinidae. And it's just, we call them whales when they reach a certain size, say 20, 25 feet, something like that. You know, it's just a common term.
Tony, you've written about whales and dolphins as being great mimics. Tell us what you mean. How do they act as mimics?
Well, mimicry is universally almost seen as a sign of intelligence and used as an important aspect of social learning in all species, including our own. And we've worked with some dolphins and whales in the wild who have exhibited fascinating aspects of mimicry, such as mimicking really their vocalizations so that they appear to be like our own above water.
You know, the story that I heard about was involved a killer whale in Puget Sound who started pushing a dead salmon around in the water. What happened next?
Well, pushing around the dead salmon in the water, that could be perceived in many ways. But what we saw from this and other solitary orcas who are in the wild, as well as belugas, is that sometimes they will appear to give us gifts. And it's something that's unusual because these animals have apparently not been fed by humans. And it perhaps exhibits not just intelligence, but a generosity that they may have extended towards our own species.
Now, in the story that I was reading, it said that this whale started pushing around a dead salmon in the water kind of playfully. And Naomi, tell us what happened next.
Well, I'm actually not aware of that particular story, but just following on what Tony said, sometimes what you'll see is food sharing in whales and dolphins. They're very social, and their bonds are very tight, and they will share. A mother will share food with her offspring. Siblings will share food. And so maybe, you know, if the only social partners they have are people because they're solitary, that was an offering of food in a very sort of natural way of just sort of trying to share food.
Now, this scientist observed this whale pushing around a dead salmon, and then within a few weeks, the other whales started doing the same thing. So they were all pushing dead salmons around, although the fad then, I guess, faded after a while.
Right. I think the point of that story was that killer whales and many other dolphins and whales exhibit novel behavior, or sometimes these are called innovations, and then they spread and they fade like fads. So the issue had to do with the cultural transmission and how things might spread through a population. And so this is true for a lot of whale calls, for example. Humpbacks have new songs every year, and they clearly develop these new songs and maintain them. And that's fashionable for the season, and then it's gone the next. And so the dead salmon pushing is similar.
Naomi.
When I was doing my dissertation work up in British Columbia studying killer whales, I saw a fad that started and ended, you know, that season, you know, where males would face each other across a certain distance, and then they would just sort of start approaching each other, and then they would hit each other in the head and then move past each other. It was almost like a game of chicken, but it was very low key. It was very low energy. It was clearly play. There was no aggression. They would repeat it. And I could almost hear them giggling about it afterwards, you know, and it never was seen again after that summer.
Tony, you know, you've written about dolphins having what you call mirror self-recognition. What does that mean?
Well, Dr. Lori Marino and others have conducted numerous studies, and some of which have demonstrated that dolphins have an advanced aspect of self-awareness. They'll put marks on the dolphins' foreheads. And then the dolphins, you know, you'll have mock tags and non-mock dolphins. And some of them would really exhibit signs of self-recognition in the mirror. And you previously only thought that these characteristics of consciousness and self-awareness were within the humans and other great apes. But what we're learning is that this type of intelligence is not restricted to humans, not great apes, and perhaps not even dolphins. We're seeing signs of intelligence similar to this in elephants. And probably the more we look, the more we're going to see that we are by far not the only intelligent species on this planet.
And in fact, this was something we discussed a month or two ago on the Diane Rehm Show about birds, that there were some birds that you could put a mark on, put them in front of a mirror, and they would show awareness that they were looking at themselves. Janet, I know that that you've done research into kind of the mother-infant relationships with whales and dolphins. So tell us how that works. Is the behavior nature or nurture? That's a debate we've often had about humans. How is it with whales and dolphins?
Well, one of the striking characteristics, especially of dolphins, is that they have a really long period of development, and it seems to be a very long period of learning. So the dolphins in Shark Bay, which I study, nurse their offspring for anywhere to 3 to 9 years. And so that's longer than almost any other mammal. And usually it's a much bigger mammal, like elephants, and nurse for typically 4 years.
And what do the mothers focus on when they're kind of teaching their offspring? What do they do?
The offspring learn a lot just through observational learning. So there's a debate about whether you call it teaching or not, because teaching means that the dolphin mother is actually showing the calf what to do. But the fact is that she's going about her business and the calf is picking everything up. But what's so interesting about dolphin society in particular is it's extremely dynamic. It has what's called a fission-fusion society, much like humans, that they join and leave on a very flexible basis. So the calf isn't in the same social group. It's calling it a pod is not like you would call it with killer whales. It's very dynamic. And this means that the calf has a tremendous amount to learn about both hunting and social behavior and social interactions and who's who and who to avoid and who to approach.
And what happens if there's some break between them, with the mother is hurt, goes away? What happens then?
Well, if a calf is orphaned under the age of 3, at least in our population, the calf won't survive. There really is no way. We've had some that were orphaned at 3 that survived, but never younger than that. So they're clearly quite dependent on their mothers for everything. And so even though they go off on separations, actually, and can engage in social interactions hundreds of meters, even a kilometer away from the mother, they come back and can rely on the mother for everything.
Do they get, if they're at age 3 or above, do they get adopted? Do you have a foster dolphin family?
Well, the cases of where they lost their mothers that young at 3, one was the two males that both lost their mothers, but they were already kind of best friends, and they spent the next 5 years almost inseparable. So they kind of used each other. and then one of them had a big sister who actually spent a lot of time with one of the males when he wasn't with his little male friend.
Boy, that really sounds like humans. Naomi.
Right. Well, with killer whales, with orcas, it's even more intense, because in a lot of the populations, the males live with their mothers for their whole lives. And they will, of course, go off and mate with other females, unrelated females, but they'll always return to their mother. And so when they reach, you know, 30 or 40 years old and their mother, you know, is reaching the end of her life, if she dies, you know, what happens to that adult son whose whole life has revolved around his mother for his whole life? In some cases, they will die very soon after. In other cases, they'll move in with their sister. Because in those social groupings of killer whales, a male has to be with a female or he has no social place. And it's an extremely matriarchal society if you want to look at it that way.
Tony, this sounds so much like humans. Is that the case when you study animals of various sorts? Is this something that's really quite particular to looking at dolphins and whales and maybe great apes? I know that's another a case where we see a lot of parallels with human behavior.
Well, exactly. And in reference to your discussion about orphaned dolphins and whales, orcas, of course, being the largest of the dolphin family, we've worked to study and protect some of those individuals who have been orphaned and sometimes even geographically isolated from others of their kind, both on the west coast of Canada and the east coast of Canada with beluga whales. And we're trying to find, in a sense, how humans can become a surrogate pod to some extent if the animals can't be moved back or if the governments won't allow them to be moved back to their families. And what we're trying to do is learn from them, not just to learn about them, but to learn from them so we can learn how to best protect them. But in the meantime, we're finding that a lot of the studies we're doing in captivity, we no longer need to do anymore. We can do that in the wild.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to play some sounds of whales and dolphins communicating with one another, and we'll take your calls and questions. Stay with us. Joining us by phone now is Lori Marino. She's senior lecturer in neuroscience and behavioral biology at Emory University in Atlanta. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Now, you've done MRIs on the brains of dolphins. And my first question is, how do you do an MRI on a dolphin?
Well, the way I do MRIs, which are magnetic resonance imaging, the way I do that with dolphins is, unfortunately, I have to be a bit of an ambulance chaser. And I wait for a dolphin to die naturally and strand on the beach, and then I get the brain. And the brain is intact, it's in a preservative, and what I do is I take that whole brain and I put it inside the scanner, typically at a hospital, and I get images of the brain with all the structures intact in their normal relationship to each other, and I can do things like look at the size of the structures, look at the shape, look at how they relate to each other, and basically make three-dimensional reconstructions of different aspects of the brain.
And how often have you done this? How many dolphin brains have you looked at with MRIs?
Oh, gosh, tens. And we've actually published on something like a dozen different species, including orcas, the bottlenose dolphins, and we've even looked at the brains of fetal dolphins and neonatal dolphins as well to try to get at how the brain develops over time within an individual.
And what have you found as you've looked at dolphin brains through these MRIs?
Oh, it's been so interesting because it's kind of like being on another planet. You have a terrain that in some sense looks familiar at one level, but at another level is very, very different. What we found is that when you look at the parts of the brain of dolphins and whales that are associated with higher order cognitive processes, self-awareness, thinking, memory, social awareness, those kinds of parts of the brain of all mammals that, you know, we've identified, when you look at those same areas in the dolphin and whale brain, you see that they're very highly elaborated. But what's interesting is
And by highly elaborated, now what does that mean and what does that suggest?
Well, what it suggests is a very high degree of intelligence, a tremendous processing capability. So if, for instance, you look at the cortex, the neocortex, a new part of the brain, the outer part of the brain in mammals, we have that. It's the wrinkled gray part of the brain. Ours is very, very elaborated. We've got all kinds of different features in it, different types of layers, lots of cells, a lot of surface area. And we think and know that that is related to our intelligence. Well, when we look at that same organ, that same part of the brain in dolphins and whales, we see that it is also extraordinarily complex in a different way, but in a way that tells us that this is a brain that has evolved to process very complex aspects of information.
And do dolphin brains have the same structure as human brains? Do they look alike?
Well, excuse me. Dolphin brains are very, very similar to human brains because they're mammal brains. But when it comes to the neocortex, they are very, very different. And that's what's so interesting. I think Janet Mann mentioned in the beginning of the show that dolphins and whales are like us and unlike us, and that's exactly what you see in the brain. Some parts of the brain are a typical mammalian brain in dolphins. Other parts, like the neocortex, are very different. And what it tells you is that there's more than one way, more than one evolutionary path to get to being an organism with a very complex intelligence. It's really quite fascinating.
Now, one last question. What are the studies that you've done? What are the implications for them when you look at human behavior, for instance, keeping these mammals in captivity?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously, when you look at the brain of an animal like this, you see that this is the brain of an animal that's very intelligent. But you don't need to look at the brain to know that these animals don't belong in captivity. All of the evidence tells us that, and the evidence that comes from their ability to thrive, their quality of life, mortality rates, and so on and so forth. It just goes on and on and on, their stress levels and so forth. I mean, these animals clearly don't belong in captivity. There's just no way that you could meet either the physical, environmental, or social needs of an orca, a bottlenose dolphin, or any of the other cetaceans in a captive artificial environment.
All right, Lori Marino, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
You're very welcome.
Lori Marino, she's senior lecturer in neuroscience and behavioral biology at Emory University in Atlanta. Let me ask the panel that's with me here in the studio about the implications for human behavior of these studies you've done looking at dolphins, whales, their social networks, their intelligence. What do you think, Naomi?
In terms of what aspect of human
Well,
behavior?
I guess there'd be two things. One is the hunting, for instance, of mm-hmm. whales, which has been controversial. And another is what Lori was mentioning about keeping them in captivity.
I don't want to be, you know, a speciesist. I don't want to take sides, and I don't want to say one species has more value than another. That's not what I'm about to say. But in terms of ethics and in terms of sort of morality, you know, there's certain species that may deserve some special consideration. And any species that's very social, very long-lived, and very intelligent, I think, sort of reaches that level. And dolphins and, you know, whales that are related to dolphins are very much in that class. And so I think that I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to try. I'm a very biased person. I very much oppose the hunting of these animals, and I oppose the keeping of them in captivity. And I'll be very, very upfront about that. But I'm not going to try to be judgmental here. I'm just going to say people really need to think about what we do and how we treat these animals, keeping that in mind, keeping in mind how social, how long-lived, how intelligent they are.
And Janet, what do you think?
Well, I think given that these animals are in captivity, that we should do everything possible to maximize the complexity and as best we can mimic the natural environments, which are very dynamic. I think a lot of people look at the water and think, oh, it's just water, but it's not. Divers know, and other people that go underwater can see what a dynamic and complex environment it is. That said, animals who are in captivity, they can't just be released in the wild, and that's because there is so much learning that goes on for this long period of development that you can't just free them and expect them to survive. Even if they can chase and catch a fish, that doesn't mean they can do it in the wild. So this is a very difficult issue. I think the argument on the other side is that it offers educational value, and this is the only way that people are going to see these animals. And I think it's our responsibility, given that we should give them, if people agree with that argument, then they have to do everything they possibly can to enhance the conservation values of these animals and the educational value of the animals in captivity. And that isn't always the case.
Before we go to the phones, I want to talk for a moment about communication among dolphins and whales. Tony Frohoff, I have a copy here of your book, Dolphin Mysteries, where you talk about dolphin communication. How do dolphins communicate?
Well, dolphins do communicate in ways that defy some of our own abilities even. And in fact, they have abilities that supersede those of our own in many characteristics. They are capable of echolocation.
What is echolocation?
Aspects. Echolocation is an aspect, what we call it, the equivalent of its sonar. And it's something that even our own Navy and our highest technological inventors have not been able to mimic, where a sound is emitted from the animal or from a piece of technology, and sound is received, and a picture, so to speak, in the animal's mind or on an oscilloscope or whatnot, a piece of equipment is obtained. To this point, if I could just jump back quickly about the captivity issue, dolphins, the ability for them to even communicate with each other is highly compromised in captivity. And these are not just intelligent animals, but the studies that Lori Marino and others have been doing have been finding that they physically, from a neurobiological perspective, it's absolutely clear that they're emotional animals as well, and that they are capable of joy and suffering, perhaps to the same degree, if not even more so than we are, because those parts of their brain are absolutely uniquely developed. So it's not just a philosophical argument, it's a physiological argument that more and more scientists are concerned about, because we are finding with dolphin sanctuaries that are in transition and being developed, and those that have occurred, that some dolphins can be released very successfully to the wild. Not all, but some. And so I think we're in a new era of looking at dolphins in the wild in their natural environment rather than seeing them in goldfish bowls where they can't even communicate with one another.
Let's listen to just very briefly to some recordings we have of dolphin and whale communication. First, we're going to hear some orcas. And now some spinner dolphins. And finally, some beluga whales. Oh, Now that is some remarkable. Those are some remarkable sounds. Tell me, anyone on the panel, what you heard, what you were hearing when we listened to those recordings.
Well, with the orcas, what you were listening to was a dialect. Orcas are sort of unique in this regard. Each different population has a dialect. And within a single population, different maternal groups will have different dialects. So what you were listening to was a specific family using the calls that family passes down through the generations. The second group of sounds, what you were hearing a lot there was echolocation, those really strange zipper-like sounds, you know, where the dolphins using their echolocation, and then you heard an occasional chirp or whistle in amongst all of that. And then the third group of sounds, belugas are known as sea canaries. They're under the ice, and they're just crazy like that. And it's not a silent world.
How, Janet, anything you'd like to add?
Well, one thing that's really noticeable about dolphin sounds is, and whale sounds, is their diversity. And the range of their calls are just incredible. And if you could reverse it and play to the dolphins what we sound like, it would be something like, because it would be so darn boring. I mean, it's so flat. And so they must be, if they were looking at us, they'd be like, how can they possibly be saying anything worthwhile?
Tony, what did you hear when we were playing those recordings?
Oh, you know, it's just such a wonderful, rich sound. And again, we're really, as Janet said, we're not even hearing all of it. And I think that what we have as MRIs and telephones, dolphins and whales, if we give them a reasonably silent environment in the wild without a lot of boat traffic, they have the equivalent of what may be seen as telephones and radio stations and MRI equipment if you include their sonar. I mean, without technology, they just have developed this amazing neuroanatomy and physiology that enables such incredible and incredibly functional sounds to occur, and they use them for communication, hunting, and expression. So it's just fabulous.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. We'll be joined first by Vic. He's calling us from Shreveport, Louisiana. Vic, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I know it's probably not popular, but dolphin meat has been a part of culture the cuisine for centuries. And I'm just wondering how you could get past all that.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Vic. Janet?
Well, my answer to that, because this has also been the Japanese claim that this is part of our culture, but there are lots of cultural practices that we now deem reprehensible. And so the culture argument, I think, is not in of itself. There are lots of things that we don't do anymore because we don't think they're a good idea. So I don't think in of itself that's an argument against changing the practices.
Naomi?
I'm involved in the issues related to hunting of whales and dolphins around the world. You know, that's what I do at the Humane Society International. And so, again, as Janet just said, you know, just because something's traditional or cultural, cultures evolve. And, you know, that's one argument we'll give to those who say this is part of our tradition. Traditions evolve, cultures evolve. We want to be respectful, but at the same time say, you know, we've learned so much about these animals. Science has advanced. And again, the ethics and the morals of what you're doing, you really need to start thinking about that. Just because you've always done it doesn't mean you always have to do it.
Now, in June, we saw the International Whaling Commission keep intact, I guess, the ban on commercial whaling, although there are some nations that continue to hunt whales. Where does this stand now, Naomi? Just bring us up to date.
Thank you. Yeah, I attend the International Whaling Commission, so I was right there in Agadir, Morocco, when all of this was happening. And the commercial hunting ban has been upheld. It continues to be in place. But there are ways around that. There are loopholes in the treaty. And so that's how the three main whaling nations, Iceland, Norway, and Japan, continue to whale, despite concerns and condemnation. What they're doing is technically legal.
Now, these are not really outlaw nations. We don't usually think of Iceland, Norway, and Japan as being operating outside international parameters of behavior. What is their justification for continuing to hunt whales?
The main justification is, in fact, what the gentleman on the call said, you know, that it's part of their culture, it's part of their tradition, and they don't want to be told by outsiders what to do. And again, I'm very respectful of that, and Americans don't like to be told what to do. But again, once you acquire enough knowledge, either through science or other means, that tells you that maybe you need to start questioning what you've always done, well, start questioning what you've always done.
Naomi Rose, she's senior scientist for the Humane Society International. She specializes in international marine mammal protection issues. And I'm also joined in the studio by Janet Mann. She's a professor of psychology and biology at Georgetown University. She directs the Shark Bay Dolphin Research Project and is author of the book Cetacean Society's Field Studies of Dolphins and Whales. My apologies if I mispronounce that. And by phone, we're joined by Tony Frohoff, director of the Terramar Research and co-author of the book Dolphin Mysteries. We're taking a short break. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Brian May, Queen's guitarist, who wrote this song.
What could you give an audience that they could do while they're standing there and they're all crushed together? They can stamp and they can clap and they can sing some kind of chant.
May talks about Queen and new surprising directions he's taken on the next Fresh Air.
Kicking your can all over the place, singing,
we will, we will.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and we're talking about whales and dolphins as part of our Environmental Outlook series. With me in the studio, Naomi Rose with the Humane Society International and Janet Mann with Georgetown University, and joining us from Santa Barbara, Tony Frohoff, who is director of Terramar Research. Let's go to the phones and take some calls and questions from our listeners. From Franklin, Ohio, Eileen's been holding on. Eileen, thanks for holding.
Hi. I am calling, and I want to say how wonderful I think that it is for this awareness to be brought to the world community that these creatures have hearts and souls, if you will, and certainly a very superior intellect. And I think that it's interesting that when your panel compares their behavior to humans, they are not qualifying that they are comparing that to exemplary human behavior, because I have to say that I think as human beings we could be studying these creatures and learning from them to be benign and peaceful and nurturing to each other, which we often aren't in the human society. And that's about the only comment I had to make, but I'm certainly glad that there are individuals out there working toward a better future for our sea creatures.
All right, Eileen, thanks so much for your call.
I don't want to pour rain on her parade, and I think what she said was lovely. But the fact is these aren't one-dimensional creatures that are all benign and loving. I don't think that does them enough credit. I think that's actually a disservice to them. They're just as complex as any other social animal, including human beings. They have their moods. They have their dominance hierarchies. They have their issues with each other. They can fight. And I think that more complex, three-dimensional way of looking at them does them more credit than just seeing them as sort of a Hallmark card. And so I don't want to oppose what she said. I think that is important to recognize that they are pretty benign as mammals go, but don't sell them short. They are complex, three-dimensional creatures.
Janet?
Well, I was just going to add a little bit to that. They are... I mean, how do I say it? They do form these very close, intimate bonds. They do help each other. They do a lot of the behaviors that we consider the hallmark of complex social animals. And that includes aggression and forming alliances and getting in spats with each other because they also have self-interest to look out for. So we see, especially in Shark Bay, we see a lot of very cooperative behavior, but we also see extremely competitive behavior as well.
And we have a question from William, who's calling us from New Hampshire, asking if the panel could explain about the case with the killer whale who recently killed his or her trainer in Florida. Who could talk about that and what was happening there? Naomi Rose?
Thank you very much for that question. Tilikum is the oldest male orca in captivity. He's in the Orlando facility of SeaWorld. He killed his trainer in February. He's actually been involved in the deaths of two other people. So this is the third death that he was associated with. But in this case, he deliberately pulled her into the water, and it was an extremely violent interaction. In my opinion, and I am an orca biologist, and I have been very involved in the situation since February. I've been doing a lot of discussing this with government agencies and regulators and the media. I think that the reason it happened was because this is an extremely unnatural situation for a male orca to be in. He's more or less socially isolated and has been for many, many years. He's used as a breeding bull, which is not a natural situation for these animals to find. It's not a natural social grouping at all. And he must be very frustrated, if nothing else, not to mention bored and lonely. And the bonds he has with his trainers are the most important he has, and something went wrong that day. I'm not saying he meant to kill her. In fact, I'm very sure he didn't mean to kill her. But he was acting out on something that was going on in his own head, and she died. And the fact that nothing has changed for him since then, except that he's become more isolated to keep the trainer safe, to me, that's really the wrong way to have handled this situation. He's not at fault, but he is paying for it.
What do you think should happen with him?
I have recommended to SeaWorld that he be retired to a sea pen with another whale that would give him more stimulation, more options, more challenges, and just a lot more space than he currently has. He would still be under human care. He would not be released to the wild. He would be retired. And I think that that would help his mental health as well as his physical health, and it has been utterly rejected by SeaWorld. They're not even considering it.
Susan, if I could say something to both this point and to the point made by the previous caller. This is Tony. I wanted to say that, first of all, I think that the points about the individual variation within dolphins cannot be underestimated. I agree with my colleagues, and I think most biologists do. They have incredible personalities and individual characteristics. They also have a lot to teach us. It's not just us studying them anymore as if they're objects. We've recognized that it's who we're studying and that we have a lot to learn from them, not just about them. And the situation with this orca is one that really brings into light that you have actually a species. I call them orcas instead of killer whales, because why should we call them killers? Simply because they're efficient predators like we are. But if we look at orcas, especially the resident orca populations who have demonstrated sophisticated culture and whatnot, they live in incredibly peaceful societies. I would say that rival some of the most peaceful of our own. So yes, dolphins can be aggressive. They can exhibit all these things. But when you take an orca who is actually probably a very peaceful and highly tolerant animal, if you consider the trauma and the torture that they endure in these theme parks, and then one, it acts out. We can't vilify the victims. I mean, these orcas are the victims, and they need to be acknowledged for having a psychology, which they do. We can't treat them like produce. And so I really hope that the recommendations are followed to take care of not only this orca, but not to continue traumatizing other orcas and other animals who are clearly tolerant other than these unique circumstances in which they clearly have to give way to what may be their version of insanity.
Janet?
I was just going to say, people do really love these animals. They're crazy about these animals, and they develop bonds with these animals in their own way. And we understand a bit more about how we view our bonds with them than how they look at us and how they view our bonds with us. And we have no idea what was going on in Tilly's mind, obviously, and that's never going to be known. But I think that it's the best we can do is try to understand their perspective, or what would it be like if you could take us out of our own sort of human perspective on this and try to look at it from their perspective on how they're living. Then I think that will give us a better answer.
Naomi, you said that you've been in discussions with government regulators since this tragedy. What do you want them to do? What could the government do, or should the government do in a case like this?
Our laws here in the United States regulate the care and maintenance conditions of marine mammals in captivity. We have a set of standards, care and maintenance standards, through the Animal Welfare Act, and there are other aspects of public display that are regulated through the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So I've been talking to these regulators, trying to get them to address the social isolation and small spaces that, you know, may have been factors in what happened with Tillicum. He, again, this is the third time he's been involved in an incident like this. This is not a new thing for him. He may be a particularly troubled whale, as it were. And so I feel, just as a specific matter, something has to be done other than the routine, other than what's been done before with this whale. For all the other whales, all the other dolphins that are in captivity, I'd like to see the standards and the care and maintenance conditions improved. Larger tanks, more complex water quality, and less social isolation. So, you know, we're working on it, but it's been a slow slog.
So do you think there are steps that could be taken that would maintain some of these Sea World type parks that enable you to bring your kids to see dolphins and other animals, or do you think the whole genre is one that's inherently cruel and unacceptable?
I think that cetaceans are inherently unsuited to confinement in theme parks. I really do. I, however, acknowledge, as Janet did, that there are some whales and dolphins that are already in captivity that aren't going anywhere and may not be candidates for release. So what to do with them? I'm trying to be practical here. I have a very strong emotional feeling about the moral rightness of keeping these animals in captivity. I think it's wrong. But I'm also trying to be pragmatic for their sake. There are some animals that aren't going anywhere. So can their conditions be improved?
All right, let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to David calling us from Gainesville, Florida. David, thank you for calling us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, thank you. I've had experience with porpoises surfing. They always show up whenever there's really good waves in Florida, which is almost never, and they're always having a ball, obviously. And when we were out one day on a particularly big day, a couple of us were paddling out, and a porpoise jumped between us, and then we saw them coming out at the peaks of the waves and doing flips and riding the waves with us. And then all of a sudden we found ourselves in a circle of porpoises, I don't know, 8 or 10 of them, and in the center were a couple of porpoises face-to-face, and that lasted for a few just amazing seconds, and then they were gone off playing again. And I wondered what that was all about.
All right. Tony, what do you think? Is this something that you've experienced too?
Well, I think that's a wonderful example of the diversity that we see in these animal cultures other than our own. And it's representative of the opportunities that we sometimes have to study non-invasively dolphins and whales in the wild and to glean things about them that we would not have been able to in captivity. And it's just really, there's a new era of research in which, with judicious monitoring, where we can learn more about them in the wild as they really are, rather than looking at a snapshot of them where they cannot exhibit their natural behaviors and these beautiful formations. And we've had such wonderful opportunities to see them in the wild when they do not only tolerate us, but sometimes even approach us. And that's not by any standards to encourage people to approach them, because they are having a hard enough time feeding themselves in the wild and taking care of their young. Those are increasing challenges for them, as it is for many humans right now because of the environmental challenges. But when these animals do approach us, there are wonderful opportunities to show us for what we can do best.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now, Tony just mentioned some of the environmental pressures on these animals. Naomi, how are things going for them? Are their numbers stable? Are they endangered? Tell us what's going on.
I just wrote a chapter for a book that was the companion volume for the movie Oceans, which was a really great documentary just showing you the beauty and splendor of the marine environment, and also some of the challenges and threats that are facing it. And so I was writing about whales and dolphins and sort of the threats they face, and I have to say, and I don't want to depress anybody, but it's a really grim picture at the moment. There are still many places in the world where they're doing fine, where they're thriving, but they are still, even there, facing some threats. And then there are other places where they're not doing well at all. And I think that climate change, ocean acidification, some of these, really complex things that are going on that are hard for even me to understand. Dolphins and whales are sort of the bellwethers of the marine environment. And as they go, so go we. And I really think that we need to pay attention to these places where they're not doing well.
Janet, how about the Gulf oil spill? How has that affected these animals?
Well, I know just what probably other people would know if they went online and looked at the NOAA NIMF site, that there's over 60 dolphins that have died and a few spinner dolphins. Some of them were clearly soaked with oil. Others, it's not clear. They're doing necropsies to figure that out, and one sperm whale. But that's a lot of mortality. That's a pretty high number. And, a lot of these things are cumulative when you have chemicals in the environment that they, at such a level, it gets in the dolphins, as Naomi was pointing out. These are top predators, and so everything accumulates in them. And so it's a very serious problem.
So even dolphins who were not affected by the spill itself could find themselves affected down the road as they eat fish that...
For decades and decades, just like has been found with, the Exxon Valdez spill. And it's not going to be what we see on the surface is nothing like what is really going on.
All three of you clearly have devoted your careers to studying these animals. Tony, why? What drew you to them?
Well, that's a fabulous question. They are so charismatic. And perhaps it's also what's so, not just what's so similar about them to humans, but it's also what makes them so uniquely different in their own ways. And I do believe there's a lot that we can learn from them. In fact, I just returned from Oxford, where I spoke at TED Global about not just the intelligence of dolphins and whales, but what may be a deeper wisdom, and not deeper as compared to humans, but a different wisdom. I mean, as somebody mentioned, they've been swimming around in the oceans for millions of years with their current, or at least similar, neuroanatomical status, whereas we are really new on the scene, last few hundred thousand years. So they know something about living in balance with their environment, and yet they're highly, highly intelligent in diverse ways. So that the possibilities of learning from them are endless. And now I think we have an opportunity to give back to them.
Tony Frohoff, Naomi Rose, and Janet Mann, thank you so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much for having us.
My pleasure.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We want to thank you for listening. We want to close with the sound of bottlenose dolphins. underwater. Thanks for being with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.